We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
And good morning. Welcome to Focus. It's our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're very happy to have you with us. We're also very pleased to have this morning, in this hour of Focus, as our guest, Clay Shirky. He's someone who spends a lot of time doing consulting, teaching, writing on the social and economic effects of internet technologies. He's an adjunct professor at NYU's Graduate Interactive Telecommunications Program. He's been writing extensively about the internet, way back ever since 1996, and he does a lot of speaking on emerging technologies in a variety of forums and a variety of organizations. Some people, perhaps, will know him for a book that he authored. The title of that book is Here Comes Everybody. And the idea there that he looks at is the way in which people have used the internet, social networking tools, new communications technologies to get together. People who might not previously have known each other, they weren't neighbors. Maybe they didn't even live in the same town. But what they found out was that they had a common interest, and they were using these tools to organize, to get together, to further their interests. Could be something that was just really personal, but could be something really bigger, that was a bigger kind of project. And in a way, they were using that to make change. And that was a book certainly got a lot of people's attention. His new book is titled Cognitive Surplus, Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age. It's published by the Penguin Press, and it's just out. And it kind of takes off from the point where Here Comes Everybody left off. And we'll talk about this, about the idea that when he talks about cognitive surplus, he's talking about a surplus of unused energy and brain power that, because of these new kind of tools that connect people, really has the potential really to change the world. And he makes the argument, in fact, that we're just at the brink of a period of change that is going to be as big as the Industrial Revolution was. So hope that you can hang in here with us. Certainly calls, questions are welcome. You'd like to call in, you can talk with us and the guest, 333-9455. Here for Champaign Urbana, toll free 800-222-9455. You can also send us email, will-talk@illinois.edu. And also, we'll be talking about your supporting the station. We'll do that a little bit later, but right now we want to get into talking with Clay Shirky. And Mr. Shirky, hello.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Hey, well, thanks very much for being with us. I know that there are a lot of folks around here who are very interested in what you have to say and some of the things that you've written, because here, you know, we're a traditional media organization that recognizes that the ground is shifting under our very feet, and the things are changing very, very rapidly, and we're trying to understand that change and figure out how to be part of the change and not how to get left in the dust by this change. And believe me, it's really tough. But, you know, so what else is new? It's the same for everybody else.
The period of the shift here in what the internet, mobile phones make possible, with both moving information around, but also, you know, as you were saying in the introduction, coordinating people, right, which has been the central job of management, not just of media companies, but really of all companies, means that this isn't the internet and related digital tools isn't a change that's happening to one industry or one sector of society. It is actually a general change in the way we find each other, come together, get things done, and that's going to show up everywhere.
And that seems to me the point here, that that's really what Here Comes Everybody is all about. You're talking about how that has started to happen, is happening, and maybe we're even just though at the brink of that being an even bigger thing than it already is.
Yes, I mean one of the interesting things, and this is something I discovered, right? I came to this as a techie. I worked in that business and believed in the 90s wrongly that the technology was what was driving the change. And it was in this decade when I saw the really significant social changes start to appear. I thought, well, the technology's been around for a long time. Why is the social stuff just happening now? But I came to realize that these tools don't get socially interesting until they get technologically boring. Mm. Right? It isn't the moment where a shiny new tool appears that it changed the world. It's when everybody takes it for granted, right? It's when your mom has email. I mean, my mom's already has email. But when once your mom has email, that's the moment at which the real social changes begin. And it is when people started to take the web, started to take mobile phones, the ability to do this kind of connecting for granted, that we started to see the social effects of it rather than just the technological ones.
Well, this, though, to bring to my mind the question that how on this continuum that you're talking about, the technologies really take off once they become boring. I wonder where exactly we are with that, because I do think that a lot of people have got their toes dipped into this technology. A lot of people have email, but they're still certainly not using the technologies to the fullest extent. And I think we still have something of a generation gap here. Younger people are taking to it much faster and more quickly than older people. Where exactly do you think we are along that line from these things being new and exotic and your early adopters are doing it to the point where further down this line, everybody's doing it?
Well, so one of the things that happens, of course, is that people get their toes in the water, and at first it all seems shiny and new, and there's lots of conversations about it. It's a fairly progressive change. To take Facebook, the current sort of high watermark of social uses of this of these tools, right? It started as a thing for college students, and then it opened up to admit people other than college students, but it was mostly high school students that joined. Your point about the age gap. Mm. But right now, the fastest growing group on Facebook is above 35. So it's now become general purpose. And it will be really when people stop talking about Facebook as a funny thing and just take it for granted that people have Facebook pages and they share things on them. Those kinds of changes take, at a guess, 3 to 5 years, and then there will be something else to integrate, which is to say, I don't think we get to any sort of short-term point at which all of this stuff seems equally obvious to everybody. But we're already well past the point where the surprise about these kinds of tools has worn off and people are starting to integrate them into their lives. Mm-hmm. To your point in particular about the age gap, I did some research for the new book, for Cognitive Surplus, which came out just a week ago. And I went back to the mid-90s. And I found a bunch of newspaper articles on, shock of all shocks, old people using the Internet. Right? They're geezers go online, these kinds of titles. And in every one of those articles, the author of the article was shocked that old people would use something as sort of high-tech and shiny as the Internet and personal computers. And it was, you read those articles now, and it's completely ridiculous. The idea is the Internet's a shiny new tool for shiny new people. And then what you come to understand when you look around, the way the network is today, it's a communications tool. And so it's useful for anybody who likes to communicate, which is to say anybody who draws breath. So although these things start with a generation gap, as personal computers did, as email did, as Facebook now is, the generation gap goes away if the tool is sufficiently useful. And that's, back to the Facebook example, that's what we're seeing with Facebook today, is that after the sort of, oh, that's just for high school kids, that's just for college kids, now it turns out to be a general purpose thing, and society's integrating it sort of more broadly.
Yeah. Our guest is our Clay Shirky. He teaches at the Interactive Telecommunications Program at New York University. He spends a lot of time doing consulting, teaching, writing on the social and economic effects of Internet technologies. He's the author of two books, Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organizations, and the new one, it's just out, Cognitive Surplus, Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age, that's published by the Penguin Press. Questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just for a minute here, I want to introduce the idea that you write about in Cognitive Surplus, and it is overall just how powerful an effect, how powerful a force for social change we're talking about this thing we're talking about can be. And I guess I'm really, I love the idea of starting, as you do in the book, with talking about the early point in the Industrial Revolution, a point where there was rapid urbanization. You start out in London in the 1720s, when people just poured into the city, and people in London were kind of freaked out about that. They really, it was very shocking. It was new, so the question is, what did they do to cope?
They did was they drank. They drank a lot, and they drank a lot of gin. This was a period called the gin craze. And exactly as you said, right, the force of urbanization, right, people emptying out of villages and regions and coming into London where the jobs were, was a profound shock to urban society. London simply wasn't set up to deal with a sustained influx of people over that long a period of time. And one of the things that people turned to in this period of upheaval as just a kind of a social anesthetic was gin. Mm-hmm. And so gin consumption went through the roof. Part of the gin craze was the consumption itself going up. Part of the gin craze was the moral panic on the part of the British Parliament, who passed law after law outlawing the selling of gin, the drinking of gin, the running of an establishment that had gin in it, and so forth and so on. And none of that worked. None of that worked. What worked, instead, was reconstituting society to deal with the abundance of people that London had acquired. And it was when the pool of people, the urban density that London newly had, was thought of as a resource and not simply a problem, that the gin consumption began to go down, and we got a lot of modern urban life as we now know it today. Mm.
All right, so then now you jumping ahead to the opiate of the people of our time. You also make the argument that something really interesting happened, particularly in the post-war era, where because of a number of factors, people found themselves with a lot of something that previous generations didn't have, and that is free time. Well, what did they do with it?
Right. Well, so I mean, it's you know, we know the statistics, but I'll tell you, looking at them for the book was really surprising. The biggest use of free time since the Second World War has been watching television. The rising educational attainment, rising life expectancy, and rising population left the developed world with an incredible amount of free time. We have well over a trillion hours a year of time to dispose of as we wish. And apparently what we wish to do is watch a lot of TV. And so every man, woman, and child in the developed world has you know, on average, taken to watching TV as a kind of unpaid halftime job. And that the sitcom, in a way, is our gin, right? It is the thing that has we've used as a kind of anesthetic to deal with this enormous transition to being a post-industrial and suburbanized society.
So even
as free time was growing, and people had more free time to use, we had fewer social outlets because of the suburbanization, because we were both moving for jobs and spread apart from one another.
Yeah.
And television stepped in to fill the gap.
Yeah. So now, putting these two things now we've talked about together, you're essentially making the argument, particularly in cognitive surplus, is that we have a lot of unused brain power, essentially, that people previously, maybe we might argue that they were just wasting it. Well, now what we have, because of the sorts of things, the tools that we talked about before, now here's an opportunity for people to, let us say, do something maybe a little bit more constructive and to be participants in media, with media, in more than simply a passive way.
And I should make it clear that this isn't. I'm not arguing that all television watching goes away. Right? It's an enormous activity. This is certainly not that people are going to stop watching television. The big surprise has been the balance of the activities. In the 20th century, the balance of the activity for public media was simply we consumed. Professionals produced. Amateurs consumed. That was that. That was how the whole system worked. And in fact, we told ourselves a story But people like being couch potatoes, that really all they want to do is sit on the couch and flip through channels. And that's the kind of highest desire we have around the media landscape. And then these tools started showing up that allowed people to consume, but also to produce and to share. And you start getting things like photos on Flickr and videos on YouTube, and you start getting collaborative projects like Wikipedia and some of the really politically engaged stuff that I write about in the book, like Ushahidi, the crisis mapping tool that was invented in a moment of need by volunteers. Mm. And we suddenly see that, yes, we like to consume, but because we also like to produce and we like to share, the media landscape has become much more active and much more varied and much more participatory than it was even 10 years ago.
Yeah. And now, and again, I think, though, here that some people will look at some of the things that people have done with these tools and with all this energy and say, well, a lot of that is just junk. It's not that, you know, it's I can has cheeseburger. That's just not, they're going to look at that and say, really, was that worth doing? And you might, you have to say, well, on one level, no. But I know the argument that you make is, well, that may be at least marginally better than complete passive media use, and then I'm sure that you could also cite examples of things beyond that that you and probably everybody would agree were actually more interesting and had more positive kind of social impact.
Right, and those are essentially the two counter arguments. The first for the creation of lolcats, these cute cats made cuter with the addition of cute captions, is that yes, it's throwaway culture, right? It's good for nothing more than to amuse you modestly on a coffee break at work or what have you. But it's still doing something, right? And there is a spectrum of work from, sort of mediocre throwaway work to really world-changing work. But somebody who's made a lolcat is somewhere on that spectrum. The gap is between doing nothing and doing something. And someone who makes even a lolcat has already crossed the gap into doing something. Then the question is, and this is really where cognitive surplus ends up, this is really, I think, the open question, in society right now, is how much of the value that we're going to get out of this medium is going to be this kind of communal, participation, cracking each other up with lolcats and so forth, and how much of it's going to be real civic value? I mentioned Ushahidi earlier, the crisis mapping service. This came out of Kenya in 2008 in the aftermath of the election there. And it's a tool that takes reports from the field, principally from people's cell phones, about disasters, and aggregates them and puts them on a map. And it is a way of taking what society knows as a whole, right, where the bridge collapse is or where the building is down, and actually making it something that's public and useful. And in 2 years, that project has gone from a kind of one-off to deal with the Kenyan election to being deployed. It got deployed after the Chile earthquake. It's been deployed in Haiti. And it is all volunteer. And Ushahidi couldn't have happened without digital technology. But it also couldn't have happened without human generosity. And what interests me are the stories where both of those things are true. Because that I think, is the big opportunity we have before us, to take advantage of ancient motivations of human generosity with novel ways of coordinating our cumulative time and talents.
Yeah. We're talking this morning in this hour with Clay Shirky. His new book is Cognitive Surplus, Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age. You might also be interested in some of the ideas in his previous book, Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organizations. He has for many years been following the Internet, writing about its development, and now is well known for doing a lot of speaking and writing about the social and economic effects of Internet technologies. We need to take just for a moment here, and Clay, if you'll bear with us here. I know you're a public radio listener, so I'm sure you've...
Yes, indeed. I hear it's Pledge Drive Time.
Yes.
I'm quite familiar with those from New York.
It is Pledge Drive Time. We are coming very close to the end of our fiscal year. It ends next week. And why is that important? Well, it's important because right now we are raising the money that will pay for next year's programs. And as we go through the year, we try to make determinations about how much money we're going to need and then where we are at various points. And so it's a pretty critical time here because what we do next year is going to depend on what we're doing right now. So What we're asking people to do is make a contribution to WILL radio and television, both, you know, to the whole thing that we're doing here. And increasingly now, what you're doing is you're also helping to support our online activity, because we've been doing more and more of that for people who want to get us that way. Here in studio with me is Kimberly Cronick. She's our director of community engagement, and this is for, I know for you, the kind of things we're talking about here this morning. That's very interesting, because this is the territory we're just now beginning to explore.
Exactly. And David, if you're like me, one of the things you like about this show, Focus, as a listener, is we get big thinkers like Clay Shirky, who today is helping us understand how people worldwide are using the internet and mobile devices to make a difference, to come together, to respond to needs. We also do that. We also, in this program, go very local. We had a show not long ago where we talked about how you can sign up your kid for summer programs. We also look at hunger. We're in the community talking to folks. What is the economy's effect? Increase in hunger. We've partnered with organizations to get people access to food. So we're doing a lot here on Focus, and if you value that, if you very value the thought, the connections, the information, we'd like you to make a pledge right now at 217-244-9455. We want to hear from 20 people who make pledges during Focus today to get us toward reaching the goal of $191,000 to go by the end of this fiscal year, and we know we can do it. Pledge amount, $1 a week is $52. You can put it on your credit card. Many people are going to willpledge.org and making their contribution, or you can call us, 217-244-9455. But the main thing is to pledge now. We don't ask too often during the year, but when we do, this is when we need you to respond, because those dollars are needed to continue this kind of programming, this kind of service. 217-244-9455 or willpledge.org.
Yeah. One more thing just to remind people, and you know, if you listen to the station and you've heard us talk about the need for support, you've heard this before, but I guess I just want to make the point one more time, is that we in public broadcasting, we simply can't continue to rely on government, whether it's state or federal government funding, anymore to the extent that we have in the past, because that's just not, we just can't rely on that. And certainly we have seen those sources of funding shrink. And over time, the listener support has grown steadily. And that's a good thing, because we couldn't do what we're doing without the listener support. So, you know, if you're a regular listener, and you're not a supporter, we hope that you change that and do what you can. If we got everybody to listen to the station to give us a little bit, we'd be doing great.
Yeah, and what's so neat, David, about what you said is it's true. As our state and federal funding has decreased, our listeners and viewers and online users have responded to that. Almost more than 40% of our operating funds comes from you, the listener, the viewer, and the online user. So that's great news for us. It lets us know that we're doing a good job locally of being locally relevant. Everything from local issues to big picture issues that you can use in your daily life. So please give a call right now at 217-244-9455 or willpledge.org. We need to hear from 20 people to make pledges. And Mr. Shirky, even though you're in a different part of the country, you could pledge too online.
Don't put the touch on the guest.
Got to.
Oh, man. Our guest is Clay Shirky. He teaches at the Interactive Telecommunications Program at New York University. He's the author of the books Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organizations, and Just Out, Cognitive Surplus, Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age. The Penguin Press is the publisher. He does a lot of speaking and writing on these particular issues, the things that we're talking about, social and economic effects of internet technologies. His work has appeared in New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Times of London, Harvard Business Review, and he's spoken to many different groups and organizations about this. And questions are welcome, too. You know, you don't have to make a pledge to call in. We hope people will make a pledge, but they are certainly welcome to call.
And, of course, I was joking there, but the point I was trying to make is that we have people all over the world and region calling
absolutely.
In. We've heard from people from Wellington, Urbana, Olney, St. Joe, Arthur, Arcola, Champaign, Terre Haute. We get pledges on the web from different parts of the country, because we know people both listen live and also on our podcast afterwards. We have actually more downloads, I believe, to the show than live listeners at any given time, or at least it's around the yes, I believe that's the case. So it's kind of neat how we're able to serve people through these different technologies. So main thing is to just put a value on what you're hear each day, 2 hours a day, 5 days a week. That's 10 hours of programming that you can call in and talk directly to local, national, and international folks. 217-244-9455.
Okay. Well, we get back to our guest, Clay Shirky. You know, one of the things that, that obviously we're interested in here is, you know, the kinds of things that we've been talking about. To do this kind of organizing, people, well, they certainly don't need us. They don't need any, you know, big. They don't need CNN. They don't need the New York Times. They could do this perfectly well on their own. So that raises this for us who are in the traditional media business. That raises this question: well, what is the place now for traditional media in all of this? And can we actually help? Can in some way that it really does make a contribution to help people to do this?
Well, yeah. So I break that question into two parts. The first part, which is they don't need you. There are a lot of things in society that we don't need but still value. And I think that it is really that shift that is critical for traditional media, right? Prior to the current era, simply to say something in public was incredibly complicated and difficult and expensive, right? We had a whole bunch of words like publish and publisher and publicist, all of which were descriptions of the work required to say anything in public. And now that activity is not difficult or complicated or expensive at all. And so when you analyze it in terms of need, yes, we no longer need complicated apparatus to put things out in the public. The question now becomes, is there some value to be gotten from doing that separate from the old scarcity premium that media, you know, that media's enjoyed for the last half a millennium? And the answer that I come to in particularly in Cognitive Surplus is very strongly yes, provided that you take on the value of your listeners, not just as individual consumers of the material you put out, but also provide a kind of convening function to help them get to know each other, to help them come together and see what interests they have in common to do things together. You know, in the aftermath of, you know, these kind of disasters, whether they're man-made as with, you know, the London bombings, the bombings in the London subway, or after the Indian Ocean tsunami, one of the most important functions for media is now aggregating what individuals are seeing, right, and you know, documenting with their camera phones. That's a function that media has taken on. It's a function you couldn't do without being in partnership with your listeners, and it creates more value for everybody when you act as a convener for your own people. The second half of the question, I think, is particularly around profit. In the U.S. in the 20th century, the analysis of the media landscape said, "Oh yes, well there's, you know, there's CBS and NBC and ABC. There's the newspapers, right? The whole industry is this giant profit-making machine. And then there's public radio, right? And that was always a kind of an afterthought. Public radio was always thought to be a sort of weird, not entirely normal case, and could be regarded as kind of being different enough not to have to worry about. Now, in this environment, and listening to the pledge drive, I know it sounds hokey, and I know we all hear the pledge drive, but it's true. Right? This is media that is not held up in the traditional advertising model. This is media that we support and help co-create. And that, I think, puts the nonprofit media landscape in a very different position right now, because nonprofit media is better able to take advantage of this, you know, surplus time and talents of its listener than for-profit media often is. Hmm.
Just for a second to talk about the Cognitive Surplus, is there a way to for those people who would say, well, I sort of get the idea, but really, what sort of surplus are you talking about? That is, what sort of potential is there for channeling that brain power into something that's going to have more kind of community impact or social impact. What is there a way to put some number on that?
You know, that, I mean, not yet. And in fact, the question of numbers is really one of the complicated ones. One of the very basic metrics I invented for the book, just to have a way to describe the cognitive surplus, was how many hours did it take to make Wikipedia?
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of years ago, when I first did this calculation, it had taken 100 million hours of human thought to create Wikipedia as a whole. And that's a big number, obviously. Anything that takes 100 million hours of effort is obviously an enormous effort. Until you notice that Americans watch 200 billion hours of TV every year, or, you know, to take a different figure, that we watch 100 million hours of TV every weekend just watching ads. So even as the numbers on some of these projects are enormous, they're just a tiny fraction of the free time we have available to us. But for people looking to participate in these kinds of things, interestingly, there are an increasing number of people trying to harness these tools in ways that are more than just sharing photos on Flickr or, you know, uploading lolcasts or funny videos on YouTube or what have you. One that I write about in the book is PickUpPal, which is a carpooling service. It tries to take on the environmental problem, not by treating it as a transportation problem, but by treating it as an information problem, right? If there's enough people going from point A to point B, there are going to be enough empty seats. And by moving information around, by having people share their information about where they're going, they're actually able to increase the efficiency of carpooling. In fact, they increased the efficiency of carpooling so much that they ended up getting sued by a bus company who said essentially, now they're too good, they're starting to compete with us. So this bus company in Ontario sued PickUpPal to force them out of business. Fortunately, the Ontario government changed the law. There are lots of examples like Ushahidi, the crisis mapping service, where people can go in and help with documentation, or if they're near one of the crises, they can help by reporting or mapping things. There are shared translation services where people can translate important resources between any two language pairs they know. I mean, the field is exploding right now, and it doesn't take much looking around to find the kind of options that if someone is minded to use their little piece of the cognitive surplus to do some good, that they can find something to participate in.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple of callers here. Let's talk with them. We'll start with someone here where we are at Champaign County. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi. I hope this isn't too much of a digression, but I'm struck by the title of your Here Comes Everybody book, and it reminds me that it was a theme in Finnegan's Wake by James Joyce,
right.
And
yes.
I'm wondering whether sort of the empowerment of the everyman, the dissolutioner of the heroic Western myth in Ulysses is anyway underlies what you were talking about. It seems to me that the change of the society from a widely empowered society, which is now more possible than ever, though still defeated in a lot of ways, is part of what's at stake here. Is that intelligible?
Yeah, no, that I think is not only intelligible. I think that's exactly right. I have, you know, an amiably simple-minded view about the current change, which is that freedom is good. Right? And spelled out that short, it sounds almost too dumb to be true, but one of the things I think we've seen in the American experiment is that increasing freedom has turned out to yield benefits that no one could have predicted when the American project started. And so when I look at the communicative freedoms, particularly the communicative freedoms held up by the Constitution, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, what I notice is that two of those three freedoms have been highly restricted to relatively managed groups, right? Freedom of speech everybody enjoys, but as you point out about the kind of heroic, heroic limitations, freedom of assembly and freedom of the press have been restricted to a handful of relatively large organizations. And what I think is happening now, and hence, one of the drivers for the title of the book, is that those two freedoms are becoming almost as widely distributed as freedom of speech. The ability to say things in public and to work together with other groups of people are now much more widespread than they were, and it is both optimism about that basic project and I think a desire to shape it for civic good that has, you know, led me to do both that book and the follow-on.
All right. Let's talk with somebody else up in the northern part of the state, Oswego, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hello. I was just wondering, by the way, I'll tell you, I've donated to you guys a couple of times. You got a great show. I hope you keep you on the air. I can't say enough about you guys. So hang in there. I know it's tough. It's only going to get better. That's the way I look at it. This information era, I think it's like I'm going on information overload. I don't know about you guys, but there's so many different ways to technically, you know, get info. It's ridiculous. And how do you know what's the truth and what's not? I have a hard time trying to justify somebody's opinions because some of the opinions they throw out there basically are biased. I think they're biased one way or the other. There's like no
question. No question.
Yeah, nothing in the middle. And you know, I look at it commonsensically. You know, I'm a common sense person. If I'm going to go vote for somebody, for instance, I'm going to go vote for somebody on their credentials, not on the basis whether they're, you know, a Democrat or a Republican. And I don't see that in this country anymore. I don't see the kind of practicality you used to have 20, 30 years ago. And I think because of the information overload on a nightly basis, we've got, I don't know, news starts at 4 o'clock now and ends up at 7. And how much information is there that you need?
Well, and I think that this really, Clay, I think it really gets it, again, another kind of thing that we're thinking about, that a lot of people are thinking about, and that is, well, whether you're talking about new media or traditional media, is there still going to be an important aggregating kind of function for somebody to try to pull things together and do some kind of, you know, one hesitates to use a word like filter, but...
Not only do I not hesitate to use a word like filter, I have been saying this for some years now, that the information overload problem is really not a problem. It's not, in fact, the problem isn't information overload. The problem is filter failure. We got used to a world where you could walk into a bookstore and you think, okay, there's a book in here on fishing. I'm going to go find it. And you don't have to wade through the romance novels and the golf manuals to get there because you know the bookstore is organized in a way. The filters that we had then, all requiring professional management of a very tiny amount of content, are all now broken. And so this flood of information is crying out for new filters. It's just that those filters are now coming after the fact. Right. The old model was filter, then publish, right? Decide whether or not a book was worth publishing and then publish it. We're now in a world of publish, then filter, which is to say anybody can say anything, and you start pulling the good stuff and the mediocre stuff after the fact. I think it's no accident that many of the really significant Internet businesses that have been built, whether it's Amazon or Google or Kayak or Travelocity or what have you, have been filtering businesses. They've said to the users, right, there's so much stuff out there that you can't go through it all yourself. You need some kind of tool. So the market for filters, in an era of this much information, the market for filters is extremely high. Mm-hmm. It's just that you don't get to do it at a bottleneck anymore, which is to say the people running the filters don't get to decide what's accessible. Everything's out in public. But a filtering service that says to people, "We'll help you find the good stuff," that's incredibly valuable. I mean, there's a great example. It's been running for years now, called Arts and Letters Daily, which is the sort of the water cooler for the humanities world.
Yeah, it's really a cool side.
Yeah, AL Daily is exactly what you're asking about, which is that is a place where you go without respect to the source of the content to say, this is going to be something I would be interested in, so there's the personal value. But there's also enormous value in synchronized conversation, in not only am I going to be looking at this particular piece of content today, but but I know enough other people in my world are that I can probably have a conversation about it. And although it's not built, you know, as with everything we've been talking about, it's no longer built on scarcity or cost of putting material out in public. The value of being able to filter is still enormous.
We just have about 5 minutes left with Clay Shirky. Just to mention, we're talking about his most recent book. It's titled Cognitive Surplus. You might also be interested in his previous book, Here Comes Everybody. He is somebody who for a long time now has been writing about the Internet and about all of the social and economic changes that we've seen and will continue to see. As a result, questions are certainly welcome. Somebody wants to call in real quick. We can get him in. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I know that you have said that you think the kind of things that we're talking about, that we're really – it's early days. While a lot of interesting things have happened already, that we're still in the beginnings of this. And I know also that people have asked you, people will say, and I'm sure people have said to you, well, do you think this is just a fad? You know, it'll yeah, sure, we're all talking about it now, but it doesn't have legs. It's going to die out. You're making the argument, no, this is not a fad. This is going to be a big change. But yes, maybe we are just at the beginnings of it.
So I'm absolutely in the it's a deep change camp, and in fact one of the things I argue in Cognitive Surplus is that when, you know, particularly in the media landscape, abundance breaks more things than scarcity, right? It is when we look back in history, it is those times when a previously scarce medium has become not just, you know, get a little more of it, but has become crazily abundant, like the rise of the printing press, that the social changes have really been quite enormous. Now, that having been said, there are faddish elements to this, right? Which is to say, there are places where everybody goes crazy for a certain kind of activity. I think the fact that we've seen, you know, the rise of Friendster and then its collapse, and then the rise of MySpace and its now slow decline, suggests that just because the basic change is a real change in society, it doesn't mean that every particular instantiation of some internet tool is going to last a long time. But when you look at the deep effects, right, our ability to communicate with each other in groups, our ability to communicate at great distance, at low cost, to have things aggregated and stored and made available to us, that is now so essential that even the great skeptics, right, even, you know, Andrew Keen and Nicholas Carr, the people who write very skeptically, are themselves avid users of the Internet. Mm-hmm. And when even the skeptics are using the medium because of the good things it does, that in my mind is a sign that this isn't a fad, that this is a really significant, long-lasting change.
Well, I find myself thinking about how we seem to have some growing stable trends. Now, maybe the tools change. Maybe right. In some small ways what people are doing changes. And then they're always that, and I don't know if it's because new tools come along and they're better, or we just have the enthusiasm for new tools. I find myself thinking, for example, about your earlier comment that, well, now everybody's grandma and grandpa are doing email, and then you read something, someone says, well, you know, the kids today, they're not emailing. They're texting. They're going, you know, and nobody writes long things anymore. The 140 characters, I guess, is good for them. So here it's the same, it's sort of the same impulse, but it's a new tool. But I guess I still find myself thinking, well, all right, what's going to be the next iteration? How will the tools change? And right. Will that really change what people are doing with them or not?
Well, the minute it's framed as a kind of binary question, it becomes impossible to answer, mm-hmm. Which is to say our tools change the way we think and work, right? Tools have always done that.
Yeah.
And at the same time, they don't change the way we think and work beyond all recognition. The way I put it in Cognitive Surplus is behavior is just motivation filtered through opportunity. So a new tool is plainly a new opportunity. It's a way to do something different, but it has to appeal to ancient human motivations to actually take off. And so, you know, there has been, I think contrary to the hand-wringing about Twitter and so forth, there's also been an explosion of long-form writing. The number of people now using you know, weblogs and so forth, to write at great length about issues that, if they were asked to put them in a newspaper or magazine, would be squeezed into 600 words, is going on at the same time, which is to say the Internet is a capacious enough medium to support both the kind of bursty, short public communication of Twitter and also to circulate much longer arguments around issues people want to argue about. You know, just last year I wrote a blog post about newspapers and the media landscape, and it's 2,500 words long, and it's three times longer than I could have gotten into any newspaper. And the only place I mentioned its existence was on Twitter. So in a way, we're starting to see those media become complementary rather than competitive with each other.
Mm-hmm. The one thing that seems to be the case is that as new communications technologies come along, they add new functions, but also in some interesting ways, they recapitulate what came before. It's as if we're sort of used to something, and so we like something new, and yet at the same time, we like the familiarity of what came before, so it can't be so revolutionary that it looks like something we've never seen before. So that happens as time goes along. But I guess I also wonder, is there some way in which there is potential for something so revolutionary that we would say it is like something we've never seen, or is that just not going to happen?
You know, I mean, it really depends on the time scale. When you look back again, you know, the printing press has been my great touchstone through this period. When you look back at the printing press and the enormity of changes wrought on society by the spread of the printing press, it was, you know, it was an incredible transformation of society. It brought about the Enlightenment. It brought about the idea of the separation of fiction from nonfiction. It brought about the separation of the idea of books from periodicals. All of this amazing stuff. That change also took 150 years. So at any given moment, people are making relatively simple adjustments to existing tools, but very often those little adjustments can turn out to be something really big, right? So when the wiki was invented, it was invented for programmers to keep track of each other's work, right? A kind of a simple group note-taking tool. That was 15 years ago. And now that idea of the sort of collaborative working method, that is showing up in places that I think nobody anticipated. And so the tired conversation about is it revolution or is it evolution, it really depends on the time scale. But I think one of the great surprises is that patterns that are unrecognizable in the current landscape nevertheless can be enthusiastically adopted if they appeal to real human motivations, right? So when YouTube came along, Viacom, in fact, they just lost their suit against Google yesterday. Mm-hmm. Viacom said, this is only good for stealing copyrighted material. No one will ever make and share popular video if it wasn't done by professionals, right? And then you look at Charlie Bit My Finger, which is, you know, closing in on 200 million views. It's a minute long. It's made by amateurs. And the idea that you could assemble an audience numbered that large with no professionals anywhere in sight, completely alien to the 20th century media landscape. Also, obviously a good idea when people were given those capabilities. So I think the thing to really focus on is not the tools themselves, but to look at which human motivations the tools enable. Mm-hmm. And the surprises are going to come not so much because the tools are shiny and new, but because they do something that was really missing from the previous landscape.
Well, I'm sorry to say we're going to have to stop. We're just at the end of the time. Folks should take a look at the two books I mentioned a couple of times here. Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organizations, and the brand new one, Cognitive Surplus, Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age, by our guest Clay Shirky, and his name spelled Shirky. Don't put an E in there. If you feel the need, don't. If you're going to go looking for his work, he teaches at the Interactive Telecommunications Program at New York University. And Mr. Shirky, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, gosh, thanks so much for having me. It's really been a pleasure. Good luck.